One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The treasurer.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day. And welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and I want to welcome you to our summer series, where we're bringing you conversations from our webinars this year. This episode, we bring you a conversation from the Australia Institute's inaugural Regional Climate Diplomacy Forum with the Honourable Fiamme Naomi Mataafa, the Prime Minister of Samoa, in conversation with our Director of Climate and Energy, Richie Merzian, and youth climate activist Gladys Habu. This episode was recorded live on the 6th of October 2021, and things may have changed since recording.
I might just hand over to our Executive Director, Ben Oquist, to formally introduce the Prime Minister of Samoa. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ebony. And it was with great delight today to be joined by the Prime Minister of the Independent State of Samoa, the Honourable Fiamme Naomi Mataafa. The Honourable Mataafa has a long career representing the Samoan people in government office. She has spent 30 years in cabinet, most recently serving as the Minister for Natural Resources and the Environment, where she showed strong leadership on climate change and environmental concerns, representing her country at past climate change conferences like the one coming up in Glasgow. During her time in the portfolio, she launched the Samoan's Women in Climate Change Initiative, which she is now the patron, bringing together female leaders from the public, private and non-government sectors across Samoa. Now, as the newly elected first female Prime Minister of Samoa, her leadership is integral to the future of our region, indeed the planet. Pacific nations have long been vital in leading ambitious action on climate change, and this year will be no different. In her recent address to the UN General Assembly, the Prime Minister noted the importance of the upcoming COP26 negotiations as a point of no return and called on big polluters to demonstrate more commitment and leadership. Prime Minister, and I watched your speech again this morning, your talk of climate crisis, the existential threat, the need to halve emissions this decade, the need to end coal was a clarion call for the planet. Your calm presence, your authority, your humanity, your future vision shone through, delivering the type of speech that many Australians can only dream our government leaders would deliver. With the Pacific region on the front line of climate impacts, strong leadership from people like yourself must be front and centre in driving ambition and determining the path in this, the decisive decade for climate. It is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the Australia Institute's webinar and invite you to give your address. Thank you, Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Ben Oquist, Executive Director of the Australian Institute. Ms. Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director, Australian Institute, fellow panelists, ladies and gentlemen. I thank the Australia Institute for this invitation. This platform allows me to discuss an issue that was already a key priority for our region since I first became a parliamentarian in the 1980s. The forum then already expressed concerns about the climatic changes in the Pacific and recognized the serious social and economic disruptions it has for our region. Currently, the region has declared climate change as the single greatest threat to our livelihoods, security and well-being of the peoples of the Pacific. We have redefined the concept of security through the Boyer Declaration on Regional Security, providing an expanded concept that better reflects our security concerns. This shows the centrality of addressing climate change in defining our regional approach, in identifying our national priorities, and influencing our foreign policy. In our recent regional meeting, for example, we even adopted a declaration that would help secure our maritime zones against the threat of climate change-related sea level rise. This ensures the preservation of our existing rights and entitlements stemming from the maritime zones. For many of our coastal dwellers, king tides are invading their homes. They can only watch the sea creep closer. Sea level is expected to continue to rise, a challenge for an island with the vast majority of people and bulk of infrastructure exposed to the sea along its coastline. Over the course of the 21st century, the global climate model projections and climate science findings for Samoa indicate air temperature and sea surface will increase by 2030, more severe and frequent cyclones, increase in rainfall intensity leading to more flooding and ocean acidification will continue to impact the health of our reef ecosystems. We have all heard about the recent IPCC reports and the unlivable predictions if we do not get our act together. It is no surprise, therefore, that climate change has continued to be a core priority and policy consideration for all our decisions across all sectors of our sustainable development. Samoa's enhanced climate change actions indicate our commitment to be part of the solution, despite our insignificant greenhouse gas emissions. Some of the important national climate actions taken include, firstly, the 2020 10-year Samoa Climate Change Policy. It provides a clear national mandate for the coordination of climate change policies and actions. Our policy aims to strengthen our whole-of-government approach to empower a whole-of-society response to climate change. Secondly, Samoa has submitted its second nationally determined contribution, where we have increased ambition by including an economy-wide emissions reduction target. It also highlights important adaptation measures that are critical for building resilience. The NDC implementation roadmap and NDC investment plan will include adaptation targets and gender-responsive considerations in the form of guidelines for promoting gender and social inclusion. Despite the COVID-19 situation, we spare no effort in ensuring we are on track to meet our Paris Agreement target of 100% renewable by 2025. Thirdly, securing climate financing is key to our efforts to implement our NDCs, and especially as our transition will be dependent on new and resilient infrastructures, technology shifts towards green buildings, climate-proofed roads, and protection of local community assets. Samoa has continued to successfully secure climate finance. The challenge is to ensure that implementations are on target and impactful in building resilience. Climate financing allows us to develop, for example, a Green Climate Fund and GEF-funded flood management control scheme for the Waisinano catchment area, which covers the central business district. Funding to support community integrated management plans with adaptation interventions for district and community levels is also important. There are also health surveillance systems developed to monitor flood-related health issues. Lastly, Samoa is part of the Science, Not Silence campaign, promoting advocacy and action in line with the findings of the IPCC 1.5 degrees Celsius special report. We believe the science is important in the long-term planning we all need to take in order to avoid the crisis situation we now find ourselves in. At the national level, we are updating our GHG inventory and energy registry and finalizing Samoa's third national communication and latest state of the environment reports. Ladies and gentlemen, for Samoa, we cannot discuss COVID-19 recovery, SDGs, building back better, or plan for the next 10 years without addressing climate change. This time next month, the world will be gathering in Glasgow. The commitments to be made at this meeting is crucial. Glasgow, therefore, could be the point of no return. Hence, we must continue to push and demand more ambitious and urgent climate action from everyone. The leaders of the Pacific have appointed political climate champions that will lead our engagement on some of our core issues and concerns at the upcoming COP26 negotiations. These include climate ambition, environmental integrity, climate finance, loss and damage, and of course, oceans. While we understand the challenges with COVID-19 that all our countries are facing, we cannot use that to delay global climate action. The situation emphasizes the need to invest in COVID-19 recovery that are climate smart and in line with a low emissions development pathway. The development of COVID-19 vaccines was the fastest in history. Its rollout around the world at large scale required a massive global coordinated effort. I often ponder on how we can push for this historical, united, urgent global response at the same massive scale to help us reach the 1.5 degrees Celsius promise of the Paris Agreement. For us as the Blue Pacific, we need to inject some of that urgency and ambitious actions, like what we have achieved with COVID-19 vaccinations, to deliver the needed climate action. All major emitters need to urgently commit to strong climate action. Even with recent ambitious NDC submissions, the emissions gap is worrisome and still puts us on a catastrophic pathway of above 2 degrees of global heating. We need to push for cutting emissions in half by 2030 to help reach carbon neutrality by mid-century. The necessary climate finance to help developing countries to meet their ambitions cuts must be made available. Keeping the US $100 billion promise a year is important, therefore, for global mitigation efforts. We continue to call for scaled-up climate financing for adaptation and dedicated financing for loss and damage. While we call for COP26 to conclude negotiations on the Paris rulebook, it is important that it adopts a markets mechanism which delivers meaningful global emissions reductions. We must ensure that we continue to uphold the principle of environmental integrity and keep the Paris Agreement promise. This is key for the region when finalizing COP26 outcomes. Lastly, but not the least, the ocean absorbs nearly a quarter of annual CO2 emissions and plays a central role in regulating the Earth's climate. Therefore, oceans needs to feature more in the work of UNFCCC. This is an important priority for the Blue Pacific. Our AEOSA slogan of 1.5 to stay alive remains relevant now more than ever. All the issues listed as priorities for the Blue Pacific are linked back to that. We need a 1.5 degree world. We need the commitment from everyone, starting with our own Blue Pacific family, to our Asia Pacific family, and all our partners and friends. Climate change is at the heart of our vulnerabilities as nations and peoples. The worst part for those of us most affected is the real solution is out of our hands. Hence, we urge those who can make a difference to do so immediately. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming along to talk to everyone here today. And thank you for that wonderful address. I can see that we've got over 500 people on the line with us here. And I know people have a number of questions and we'll get to them very shortly. Prime Minister, if I may have a follow-up question there. You talked a lot about the impacts that the Pacific feels from climate change, and you touched on loss and damage and financing. Obviously, Pacific communities are on the front line of climate impacts and have the most risk to lose, despite, as you pointed out, contributing almost nothing to climate change. I just wondered if you could talk about how the COP can address that disparity through things like loss and damage and climate financing, but also specifically the role that the Pacific plays in advocating for that greater ambition.
Well, the issue of loss and damage, I think, is an issue that is still, I suppose, at a level of discussion whether, you know, it's a matter that our global forum wants to consider or not. I mean, that's still, I think, the stage at where that situation is at. But it's very critical for us in the Pacific that the issue of loss and damage is on the table. Given our specific situations, you know, we're small developing states, the impact of loss you know, on our populations happens at a level of impact that is very intense. It's immediate. You know, it's not something that is incremental. And so I think a special attention needs to be given to the issue, and we are still advocating strongly for the loss and damage dialogue. You know, because I think our situations would be such that if there is no consideration for that, our progress, if there's been any progress, it will just put us back further and further to meet our development goals and ensure a quality of life for our people.
Gladys, I might direct my next question to you. You're a youth advocate for climate action, and I know you recently met with the COP26 president, Alok Sharma, alongside other Pacific people. I was just going to ask you about why youth leadership is so important when it comes to climate. It's certainly been really important for showing some leadership here in Australia.
Thank you, Ebony. Before I answer your question, I just wanted to really acknowledge the opportunity to be part of this session. I really am humbled to listen to and speak with in person our Samoan Prime Minister, Honourable Fiamme. Being a female leader yourself in our region and fighting a brave front on behalf of all of us is amazing. And I really appreciate you advocating with that powerful speech at the start of this session. Youth leadership, in my personal opinion, is very significant in climate action, because youth are the future caretakers of this planet after the older generation. And I feel that if we are not taken seriously and empowered with the ability to participate in critical decision making, as well as receiving the necessary leadership training in the climate space today, then it will only continue to widen the gap between the ongoing climate crisis and the act of implementing the strategies that we want to see to relieve us of this crisis. You know, with all our small island developing states fighting on the front line, young people are most vulnerable. That is a fact. And if we look at the demographics of the Pacific, youth in many developing countries make up the majority of the population. And for instance, in Solomon Islands alone, 70% of our population are aged 30 years old and younger. So I see that if we are to make effective climate action, we need to utilize the youth population to give impactful results. We need to engage the majority. And we can do so by, you know, ensuring that the solutions that are proposed are realistic and relatable to the target youth audience agents in order to allow them to drive genuine and holistic climate action. Honestly, we do not want our participation to be merely participation. We want to be impactful. We don't want to be tokenized, you know. We don't want any more of this invitations coming in saying, we want to invite you because it is a part of our policy to have youth involvement. We want to be invited to the climate discussion table because we want a seat there, and you want to listen to us and you want to action our call. And I think that is very important going forward in this crisis. And I really, really hope that coming out of COP26, we get increased youth representation, especially from Pacific Islands nations, going forward.
Thank you so much. The next question again is for you, Prime Minister. I wanted to ask about, we've talked a little bit about the role of the Pacific, but it seems to have had a lot more effectiveness when working as a regional bloc to achieve progress on key issues such as the Samoa pathway, the SDG 14 for sustainable oceans and things like that. How important is it for the Pacific and other small island states, I guess, to act collectively? And are you expecting that working together and using that regional cooperation is really going to help push ambition at Glasgow on any particular issue, I guess?
Yes, of course. In 2017, the forum leaders endorsed the Blue Pacific narrative as the core driver of collective action for advancing the leadership vision under the framework for Pacific regionalism. It inspires us to assert, you know, our shared ocean geography and resources for the security and good of our ocean and the prosperity of our people. Working together as a small island developing states is vital for the security and prosperity of our countries. Our collective weight as AOSIS and PSIDS enhances our region's voice to leverage imperative actions and solutions, as well as political pressure, both regionally and internationally.
Thank you so much. We might go to questions from the audience very shortly, but Richie, I just wondered if I could come to you quickly. You gave us that outline at the very beginning about kind of the road to Glasgow and what we can expect. I just wondered, we are anticipating some new announcements from the Australian government, but are we anticipating they're going to be as ambitious as the Pacific countries would like to see?
A good question. Before I address that, I just wanted to also add just what a privilege it is to have the Honourable Fiamme Naomi Matafa for the first Regional Climate Diplomacy Forum. And also Ms. Abu Gladys as well, having them both on board. Such strong, powerful voices really do bring home the issue to Australia. Often, especially in Canberra, we feel like we're in a bit of a bubble here. The Australian government is currently considering whether to lock in a net zero by 2050 target. But that isn't where the conversation is at. Glasgow is about short-term action. And as the Prime Minister outlined, that is at an inflection point. It's at the point of no return. If we don't increase ambition at this particular meeting, then we are inbound for dangerous climate change, and our neighbours will be on the front line of those impacts. The bar has been set. It's at least halving emissions this decade. I think that would prove a credible contribution for this meet, but then going forward, ultimately, you know, reducing emissions by three quarters by 2030 would be what would be on par with the science. And that's what many would want to see the Australian government take forward. That would be in line with the expectations for actually avoiding these impacts. Hopefully we will see more come forward from the Australian government between now and COP26. But even basic questions around whether the Prime Minister of Australia will attend are still in the works as well. So really, we don't have a plan yet. We don't have a leadership aligned for the meeting yet. There's still many questions unanswered. And that's a particularly difficult position to be in when the science, when the solutions are so clear.
Mm. Thank you, Richie. We might go now to some questions that we've got here from the audience. And I know that we've got a couple of journalists on the line here as well. So I'll try and get to some of your questions. The first one is from Tom Stainer from SBS World News. His question is to you, Prime Minister. He says, in your view, does Australia need to increase its 2030 emissions reduction target? If so, by how much? And should the Australian Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, attend COP26?
Well, yes, of course, given what my opening statement, you know, we would like Australia to do that. I don't have an exact number of a level of reduction that we would ask with the Australians. I think it's a bit unfair, actually, for the journalists to be asking me these questions. Mr. Morrison will not like me for giving these answers, but, you know, this is not new to him. The Pacific position has always been very clear. As to Mr. Morrison's attendance, well, you know, that's really up to the Australian government. We ourselves are finding it very difficult to make our way to Glasgow, and even more challenging on the way back. So we still have to make a decision about our attendance, you know, in the COVID environment.
Thank you so much. The next question is for you as well, Prime Minister. It's from Jill Rogerson. She asks, would you expand on the gender responsive considerations of your climate response, which I think you touched on in your opening remarks?
Yes, I think, you know, along the same spirit of Gladys's response to the youth involvement, you know, I think the point is, everyone has to act. But then for gender responsiveness, it's well documented, first of all, you know, that women are most affected. Secondly, that they are very responsive. They organize well around those responses. They're inclusive operators. So, you know, these are all the, you know, the grounds why it is so important that, you know, starting right from the policy level, that there is recognition, that there is that resource available, you know, to the effort of meeting the climate change challenges. So I'm not just saying this because I'm a woman, but, you know, these are well proven, you know, outcomes of how they responded, not only to climate change, but many other social issues that confront our communities.
Gladys, I wonder if I might come to you for a response to that as well. As a young female climate leader yourself, how important is it to be inclusive as part of leadership roles, but also advocacy and activism?
Thank you, Ebony. Yeah, honestly, including female leadership in spaces like this is very important. And I speak from the perspective of the general female population in like rural places in Pacific Island countries, where already we come from, you know, a lot of inequality. There's so much disproportionate factors that are affecting us as females. And, you know, on top of that, we are also at the home level responsible for a lot of labor intensive work. And these are just the simplest things that we need to do to ensure that we have the most basic things available for us at home, food, water. And yet we are also affected by the consequences of climate change, making us very vulnerable. More importantly, our safety. And so coming from that perspective, I feel like females have a very wholesome understanding of how people are affected by this crisis, and hence would be able to draw better solutions going forward in this crisis.
Thank you. The next question I have here is from Tali Awa Latia. I hope I've pronounced that correctly, Tali. Her question is also for the Prime Minister. She says, Talofa Lava Fiame, Tali from the ABC. I hope I'm pronouncing all this correctly. I'm sorry, Tali. Will you be attending COP26 in person, Prime Minister, given costs and COVID impacts? She asks, what will it mean if Pacific leaders can't physically be there to Talanoa with other leaders outside of official talks?
Yes, I think because the hosts need to, have the information on who's actually attending, we will be having to make our decisions almost immediately. It's very important for the Pacific to have a presence there. But here we are, we're meeting virtually, and it seems to be the way of the world at the moment. And, you know, we sincerely hope that the hosts could entertain, virtual participation in the workings of the COP26 meeting.
The next question that I've got is perhaps a follow-up on that, just keeping with the impacts of COVID for a little bit. It's from Matthew Elmas. He says, thank you for your speech today. How crucial is it that Samoa and the Pacific region more broadly is able to secure vaccinations against COVID-19 as soon as possible, and is enough being done to redirect resources from nations like Australia and the United States to other nations?
For Samoa, and I think it is the same for our Pacific neighbours, we've been very fortunate through various support systems to receive a full or almost full complement of vaccinations. For us here in Samoa, we are very fortunate to have that for the the population that needs to be vaccinated, and for our younger population, 17 and under, New Zealand government has come forward that they will provide the Pfizer vaccination. So we're very much on track. We're at about 97% for the first shot. We're probably getting close to 60% on the second shot, and we hope that by the end of November, when the shelf life will finish by end of November. So we've got a deadline that we need to meet. We had a two-day lockdown last week where we did a whole of country mass vaccination. So that has helped make the push to reach the targets that we want to reach. But we've been very fortunate. The various partners have worked successfully to provide the vaccinations for our country and, as I understand it, for the Pacific in general.
The next question is from Joe Moiono Colio, who's a climate advisor to the Vatican. He says, Talofa Prime Minister, the Paris Agreement mandates emissions reduction from the consumption side but isn't as strong on the supply side. On that note, he says, the Dalai Lama, the Pope and a number of Nobel Peace laureates have called for a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty to halt the proliferation of fossil fuels at the production stage. Do you think Samoa and other Pacific small island nations would support that initiative, and how important? I'm adding this on, this isn't his question. I was just going to say Australia is obviously a large fossil fuel exporter. So how important are initiatives like that to be limiting or restricting coal in future?
I think it's an excellent initiative. And given the positions that we've taken over the time, it would not present us with any issues to support such an initiative.
Gladys, I wonder if I might get you to respond to that as well. Obviously, a lot of climate action and the Paris Agreement is focused around the demand side, but fossil fuel exports and the consumption of fossil fuels globally is still a huge issue. How important are initiatives like the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty?
Thanks, Ebony. I think that is it's a very important step towards maintaining that 1.5 degrees Celsius that we really hope to have. When I look at the way in which Australia is leading Oceania in terms of transitioning from this fossil fuel phase, I do believe that there is more that still can be done. It really saddens me that Australian politics is lagging the change that we hope to see in the region. I do have to say, though, that there is good. I believe change is coming. And I know the general population now are seeing like the consequences of climate change in the backyard, which will be the wind of change that we hope to see. And a lot of young people are in this. What I really wanted to say here is that we cannot ignore the reality, because the cost of ignoring it would far outweigh the benefit of transitioning into a greener economy.
Richie, I might just come to you quickly on that as well. I know the Institute's done a bunch of work, but how important is it going to be to address Australia's fossil fuel exports?
Quite important, because if you look at the impact that Australia is having, the Prime Minister noted that Samoa has an insignificant impact in terms of contributing to climate change. Australia is on the other end of the spectrum. Australia is in the top 10% of emitters just for its emissions onshore. But where it plays an even bigger role is in what it exports to the world. Australia is arguably the largest coal exporter, the largest liquefied natural gas exporter. When you put that together and compare it with other countries, Australia is the third largest exporter of fossil fuels in the world after Russia and Saudi Arabia. And if you look at the emissions involved in all those fossil fuels it exports, it's more than twice what it emits onshore. And so Australia's contribution is oversized in that way. Unfortunately, the Paris Agreement doesn't even mention fossil fuels. And that's by design, because the supply side, those who are dealing in the problem, don't necessarily want it to address that. But if we're going to solve climate change, we have to. Much like we do with tobacco or alcohol or drugs or weapons, you have to deal with supply as much as demand. And so the best thing that we could be doing is putting a halt to new fossil fuel projects. And that's in fact what the International Energy Agency recommends as its pathway to keep to 1.5 degrees.
Thanks, Richie. Back to you, Prime Minister. I wanted to ask about the GCF being a valuable source of climate finance for Samoa and the region. Would you like to see that be supported by all countries? Sorry, that's the Green Climate Fund. Shouldn't speak in acronyms there.
Yes, of course. And, we've been the recipient of such funding. And it's one of our financing is one of the building blocks, for this negotiations that we're having through the UN. So, I think the question is, should, other countries be participating? Oh, well, of course. And we're not meeting, the financial targets that have been set, and I'm sure that is one of the burning questions. How do we meet that gap? What needs to be done to meet that gap?
Richie, I might ask you to respond to that as well. I know you're a veteran of many COPs. How important is the Green Climate Fund?
The Green Climate Fund is the main multilateral source of financing for climate action. And I had the good fortune of traveling to Samoa when Australia co-hosted a Green Climate Fund board meeting in Apia, I think in late 2016. And it was the first time that the Green Climate Fund board, which is the 40 countries, half from the developing country side and half from developed countries, actually went to the Pacific and saw firsthand climate impacts and agreed to scale up climate finance as well. Since then, unfortunately, Australia has pulled out of the Green Climate Fund, and it would be great to see Australia rejoin, recommit and replenish back into this fund that has had a major role in financing climate action in the Pacific and more globally, because climate finance is the glue. It holds together ambition, particularly in countries that aren't necessarily responsible for climate action, but have to deal with those impacts. And so it's the goodwill that developed countries provide and help mobilize that seals the deal and helps prepare countries for those unavoidable impacts. And it would be great to see Australia rejoin the Green Climate Fund, given it has played a key role in the past. And as the Prime Minister said, of course, all countries should be involved in the solution.
Thanks, Richie. Prime Minister, the next question is for you. It's from Dan Jervis Bardi. He says, what impact, if any, would the Australian government's failure to commit to more ambitious emissions reduction targets have on its relationship with Samoa?
Well, in any relationship, there are things that you agree on and things you don't agree on. So, you know, you carry on with what you agree on and you continue to dialogue and negotiate on, you know, on issues that still needs work. I think, you know, if with this discussion about security, for instance, so, you know, the environmental security for us is priority. So, you know, we've had discussions on, you know, what are the definitions of security, including environmental security and so forth. And, you know, there's even now moves internationally with the international courts on what would be considered, you know, crimes against the environment. So, you know, all that kind of discussion is taking place because, you know, of the impact that climate change is having on all our lives. So, I mean, we will continue to have the conversation with Australia. You know, I don't think we will get to the point where we say, okay, we're going to cut off diplomatic ties or so forth. You know, that's not how it works. You know, in any kind of relationship or community, you know, whether it's small community, large community, global community, you know, you hope, and this is a Samoan way for us too. We always want to be at the table and to continue to be talking.
Gladys, the next question is from you. It's from Anastasia Lay Sam. They say, Talofa, Fiamme and Gladys, in talking about youth leadership in climate change, is there a good representation of youth at the COPs? And is there any changes you would like to see in COP26 to improve youth representation given its importance? Thanks, Gladys.
Thanks, Ebony. To be honest, I think over the years, youth representation has improved sort of slowly, although I do believe that we are, or Pacific small island developing states are still underrepresented at a lot of these global events, including COPs. And so going into COP26, I'm really hoping that this is one of the priorities to increase youth Pacific representation in these discussions. Although I understand it will be very difficult considering the pandemic and travel restrictions and all that. So alluding to what the Honourable Prime Minister said before, hopefully we could maximise this by having the opportunity to join in virtually, because, yeah, I believe youth voice is very much needed.
The next question is from Paniani Patu, who asks, what can Australia do to lead the way to advocate and pursue the Glasgow COP26 target of 1.5 degrees? Prime Minister, I might address that one to you.
Well, I'm not Australian. I know what I would do if I was going to Glasgow, but I think it's a bit unfair to ask me what Australia would do. But, I mean, we all know Australia's situation or their position, you know, with regards to climate change. I don't know. I mean, I think Richie's suggestion, you know, is perhaps they could come back to the financing table. That would be a good start. You know, take away one hand, put in with the other hand. You know, that's the way things work.
Thank you. Richie, I might just get you to respond to that. If you could talk to the Prime Minister today and give him some advice, what would your advice be?
Sure, I'll take that one as the token Australian. So I think the Prime Minister's right. Rejoining the Green Climate Fund would be the first step, and that would include a new commitment of climate finance. Australia put in $200 million into the first commitment period. Doubling that contribution and putting into the Green Climate Fund $400 million would be a good faith start. Secondly, increasing its nationally determined contribution. It's currently 26%. It should be at least 50%, but really higher is better. The third, hitting pause on any new fossil fuel projects. There are 20 new coal projects in New South Wales alone, let alone all the gas that the gas-fired recovery that the Australian government currently is interested in pursuing would unleash. So hitting halt on fossil fuel projects would also be another good step. So that there's no shortage of steps and no shortage of opportunity for the Australian government to re-engage in the international community and show that it does take climate change as seriously as its Pacific neighbours, who have constantly said this is the number one security threat. And in fact, Australia, as part of the Pacific family, as a member of the Pacific Island Forum, also shared those sentiments in saying it is the greatest threat to the Pacific, and that's what it should actually follow up on doing.
Prime Minister, and hopefully a straightforward question, which is, when is Samoa planning to open its international borders? We've got a lot of people here on the chat today and from the diaspora and tourists who are keen to visit. How soon can we all get to Samoa?
Well, we're all keen for all of us to visit each other. I'm sorry that I cannot give you a set date. You know, we seem to be living in a world of uncertainty. We've just signed a one-way quarantine-free arrangement with New Zealand, starting with a class of people, the RSE workers, but through those negotiations, we've also put in our students, some of our medical cases, Samoans with New Zealand passports. So, you know, this could be a similar arrangement with Australia. I mean, already we have our seasonal workers coming over to Australia. So it's very much sort of prioritizing sort of economic elements, but the social ones, you know, people returning families or uniting families or just having a holiday, I think those kind of things are going to still take a while before that happens.
Thank you. Ben, I wonder if I might come to you for some final thank yous.
Thank you, Ebony, and thank you, Prime Minister. Before I thank Prime Minister formally, thank you, Ebony, for hosting us today and all your good humour and professionalism in grace in hosting these events, which I think are really playing an important part in our democracy, actually. There's some big debates going on. We've touched on some of them today, and allowing the Australian public to participate in them directly, I think, has been one of the there are any upsides to the pandemic, and there aren't many. That's one of them, and hosting these and running these forums with, as I said, with such professionalism, grace, and good humour has been one of the only upsides. So thank you very much on behalf of Australia's democracy, Ebony, and Richie for putting us together here today. Your leadership at the Australia Institute, running its climate energy program, your force of nature, and working on so many fronts and driving that is leading to better outcomes for Australia and I think, in fact, the world. So thank you very much, not just for this, but everything you're doing and the leadership you're showing. Gladys, great to meet you too. Good luck getting to Glasgow if you can. We look forward to working with you some more in the future too. And yeah, thank you for everything you're doing. You know, the planet needs strong advocates like the Prime Minister. But they also need the next generation. And it's great to hear from you today and your insights and look forward to working with you some more. But finally, Prime Minister, thank you so much for your leadership through the pandemic and through the recent democratic challenges too that Samoa's had. You know, it feels like to me that Samoa's coming through that stronger, that your democratic institutions have been tested, but your leadership has seen the country through that. And now the big challenges that the world faces, not just COVID, and you're having to handle all that Samoa, but the future challenges and the reality of the climate crisis is upon us. And that your vision and leadership shone through today as it did in the UN the other day. And I am just, not that you need it from me, but the planet so needs women like you to speak up strongly and with authority and with courage like you're doing. So all strength to your arm, and thank you for what you're doing for your country, but thank you for what you're trying to do for the planet. Australians need you and voices like you and action from leaders like you. Good luck with everything you're doing, and thank you so much for taking the time to share that knowledge and insights and vision directly with us and through us, the Australian public today. We really appreciate it.
This has been a special webinar episode of Follow the Money. All our webinars are free and available on the Australia Institute's YouTube channel, which you can find at australiainstitute.tv. All our latest research and content is at our website, australiainstitute.org.au, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is ebony_Bennett with a double N double T, and this episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and you can find her at Jennifer Macy. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you for listening to Follow the Money, and I hope you're having a great summer.